From Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International, it's To the Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Jim Fleming.
Both my parents drank heavily. My father, when I came home for break, handed me a flask of whiskey when I got off the bus at about, 1 o'clock in the afternoon.
That's best-selling writer Mary Carr on her family and the beginning of her struggle with alcohol. More from her later on. This hour, Telling Addiction. From a physician at North America's only supervised injection site to the cardiologist who hit rock bottom as an alcoholic and found his own cure.
A complete indifference. It wasn't abstinence to alcohol. I could see alcohol and look at it as if it were an ashtray or a vase or a flower.
Also, getting hooked on Second Life.
It's 6:10 and I've been on at least 12 hours total.
Gabor Maté has seen everything. He's a physician at OnSite, the Vancouver detox facility associated with North America's only supervised injection site. He's cradled his patients after they've been raped, treated them during overdoses, and gone to their funerals. Now, he's asking that society try to understand the addicts among us and tells us why compassion makes sense from a scientific, humanitarian, and political perspective. Maté's book is called In the Realm of Hungry Ghosts. One of his patients is an addict with a brilliant mind and an erratic personality.
He's a man who injects stimulants, and he's a brilliant man who writes quite dramatically effective poetry and who speaks several languages and who's completely embittered, knowing that I'm Jewish. On his bad days, he comes in hoisting a Nazi salute and shouting out Heil Hitler's and other lovely Teutonic slogans. But when he is a bit calmer and free of the effects of his drugs, apologizes and tells me that all human beings are alike and the same, and that God doesn't want anybody to be hurt or discriminated against, and who tells me that he does cocaine only so that he can feel a sense of aliveness and connection. So there's this deep contradiction inside him, and unfortunately, he's too much in the grip of his drug habit so that he doesn't actually reach that state of spiritual equilibrium that he so longs for. But he's quite an astonishing person to talk with and very interesting to get to know. And of course, I don't take his rantings personally because they're not personal. He doesn't even mean it. It's just him under the impact of a particularly toxic chemical.
Well, tell me about the work that you do in downtown Vancouver. You are at the only on-site injection center in Vancouver. It sounds new to me.
It's called the SIS, or InSite, North America's only supervised injection site. In Vancouver, downtown Eastside, which is North America's most concentrated area of drug use, apparently, it's a facility where people can come, bring their drugs, and inject them under supervision. They get these cubicles with lights, clean needles, sterile swabs to wash their arms with, tourniquets to facilitate injection. And they inject their drugs under medical nursing supervision. The idea and the benefit is that people do not pass on infections to one another because they use clean needles that are then discarded. They do not inject themselves with puddle water and unsterile materials. They have less risk of causing infections to themselves. And if they overdose, they are actually in a place where they can be resuscitated, which has happened many dozens of times.
How many people do you see in an average week there?
Oh, it's hundreds a day. The facility goes from early in the morning till very late at night. I think there's several thousand people registered there.
Now, this is one aspect of the work that you do, but there is another, and that's counseling people who are addicted. You see people at various sites in downtown Vancouver. What's it like seeing one addicted patient after another? Do you get to know them as people?
Well, one way to put it is to see one addicted patient after another. Another way to put it is you see one suffering human being after another. And what you get about these people is that invariably and without exception, they all began life as abused children. It's abuse that sets up the template for addiction later on in life. in the majority of cases where there is severe injection drug use on the street level, that's just true not only according to my own particular observations, but also according to large-scale research done in the U.S. In other words, as a physician, I'm dealing with people at the extremes of suffering. They suffer because of their life history, then they suffer because of their addiction, and finally they suffer because of the social opprobrium and prejudice against the addict. So it's an area of medicine that's highly challenging and highly rewarding at the same time. And yes, if you're doing your job as a physician, you must get to know these people as individuals. And when you do, you find that many of them are very sensitive, creative people, deeply hurt, sometimes hardened, as a defense against the suffering that they've endured, but always interesting and always worthwhile to become acquainted with.
You write in the book that the people you work with are under extremes of stress and that this plays a huge role in how they become addicts. What kind of stress are we talking about?
Well, in the Vancouver downtown east side, a drug ghetto, as I call it, I've never had a single female patient who wasn't sexually abused as a child. I mean, not even by accident. And the men were abused physically, a large percentage of them, a large minority of them sexually, and they were neglected and abandoned serially over and over again. And when you look at the large-scale studies in the United States, the so-called adverse childhood experiences study, an adverse childhood experience is something like a parent dying, a parent being addicted, violence in the family, a child being abused, a rancorous divorce, and so on. For each adverse childhood experience, the risk of injection using substance addiction goes up exponentially. So by the time that a male child had six of these experiences, his risk of becoming an injection-dependent substance addict is 4,600% greater than the average.
You see this by experience, of course. You see it happen generation after generation. Is there brain science that also confirms the diagnosis you've made?
Well, absolutely. We have now sophisticated imaging techniques. For example, in one study, they looked at the MRIs, magnetic resonance imaging of depressed adult women, some of whom had been sexually abused and some had not. And there were noticeable markers in the brains of people who had been sexually abused. It's really clear now. The human brain develops in interaction with the environment. And under conditions of stress and abuse, you have brain impairments, the circuits that are meant to regulate us and give us those feel-good chemicals like the endorphins, our own natural opiates. They don't develop those circuits very well under conditions of stress and abuse, which is why when that individual does cocaine or heroin for the first time, they feel normal for the first time. You see, the drugs in themselves are not addictive, contrary to popular myth. Most people who try most drugs don't become addicted to them. Otherwise, we couldn't give morphine in hospitals to people in pain. But we can do so quite freely without really worrying about addiction potential in the vast majority. But those people whose internal opiate circuits were negatively affected by early stress and early abuse, they're the ones then who, when they do an opiate like heroin or morphine, become hooked on it because that's what they've been lacking all their lives.
This also argues that there is behavior that parents can engage in that would create the structure of the brain to make people not become addicted, that there is something that is the flip side of what you're talking about. This suggests that the more responsive and loving a mother is to her child, for instance, that the less likely that child is to become addicted?
Well, absolutely. In my book, I argue that the beginning of addiction needs to begin at the first prenatal visit. And if I take your question a bit more broadly, I have been diagnosed with ADHD myself, and I don't believe it's a genetic condition, as most experts seem to believe, I think according to very poor evidence. What it's really all about is the impact of the environment on sensitive infants whose parents are stressed. So I'm not even talking about bad parenting, I'm talking about stressed parenting. And the reason we're seeing so much more of these childhood conditions in North America these days, with all the millions of kids on medications, is because the parenting environment has become terribly stressed. So if you look at the brain's electroencephalograms, the readouts of the electrical activity of the brains of infants with depressed mothers, comparing to the infants of non-depressed mothers, you can tell from the EEG of the child whose mother is depressed and who isn't. So I'm not talking about the amount of love that a parent has or the dedication or the commitment. I'm talking about even how stressed the parents are, because that actually has an impact on the child's brain development. Now, when on top of stress, you throw in abuse, that kid hasn't got a chance, virtually speaking. And you're absolutely right. It follows that if we actually helped parents provide nurturing, loving environments, which we don't, we could prevent a lot of childhood disorders. In America, in the United States, I should say, the average maternity leave is something like 3 to 6 weeks, up to 3 months at the very most. And that means that kids don't see their mothers from early age onwards. And that has a huge impact on brain development.
So what you seem to be saying, in part at least, is that we are... Our societal reaction to addiction is exactly backwards, that we are, in fact, treating people with the opposite of what they need in order to have any hope of freeing themselves from this particular addiction.
I couldn't say it better than you just did. The literature clearly shows that the major driver of addiction and relapse is stress. And that means that the more you stress people, the more likely they are to engage in addictive behaviors. And by the way, the obesity epidemic in North America is simply a stress epidemic. People are soothing themselves with their food. It's just an addiction. It's not a question of junk foods and so on. Junk foods release the same endorphins in the brain that the opiate addict is after, actually. So the problem is that when people are stressed, as they are right now economically, more people are eating junk foods.
So my bag of Cheetos is the same as a shot of crystal meth?
Not crystal meth so much as maybe a shot of heroin. And you can block the effect of it by giving you a medication that would block the effects of heroin. So that what I'm saying is that if stress is the biggest driver of addictive relapse, then what on earth are we doing stressing people with this irrational so-called war on drugs? There's no war on drugs. You can't war on inanimate objects. There's only a war on people. And the people that we're warring on are the people that began life under the most adverse and horrible conditions, the abused children who grew up to be adults and then grow up to soothe themselves through those substances. That's who we're making the war on.
Gabor Mate is a physician with OnSite, North America's only supervised injection site in Vancouver, Canada. He's the author of In the Realm of Hungry Ghosts. Coming up, best-selling writer Mary Carr journeys from addiction to awe in her new memoir, Lit. If you'd like more information about the books or music you hear in the program, you can get in touch with us through our website, ttbook.org. I'm Jim Fleming. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International. Mary Carr's first memoir, The Liars Club, kick-started a memoir revolution and earned her a spot on the bestseller lists. This time around, she takes another personal look at her own life and her struggle with alcoholism in the memoir, Lit. Here she is with a reading from the book about life with her husband, Warren.
I wouldn't call my pre-Warren drinking out of control because I had control. So long as I didn't leave my apartment, I didn't drink. In Cambridge, though, that person no longer exists. With an invisible eraser, I'm internally rubbing hard at the core of her, and Warren's steady, unwavering gaze is lasering away her external edges. Soon, she'll be missed. I stand at the bar, its tiered bottles like a shiny choir about to burst into song. With only $5 or $6 in tips, how much trouble can I get in? Warren will pick me up soon, and the bar's on the cusp of closing early. At one end, a man in evening clothes with long gray hair swept back sits behind a sherry glass. On the stool next to him, a tipped violin case. Across from him is the despicable waiter, cradling a brandy snifter, his normally ponytailed hairs undone. The waiter says, "Buy you a farewell cognac?"
Carr told Steve Paulson that drinking too much runs in her family.
My mother was a binge alcoholic, I would say, and so she might go a year even without touching a drop, but you never knew when she drank where she'd wind up. You know, she'd be gone for, sometimes she'd be gone for days. She'd just disappear and be holed up drunk somewhere. But yeah, she'd get drunk and marry people. She'd get drunk and shoot at people. One of my favorite stories is, you know, prying off the tile in the kitchen when we were retiling it right after The Liars Club was published. And the tile guy said, "This looks like a bullet hole," thinking it was a joke, you know. My sister said to my little 80-year-old mother, "Isn't that where you shot at Daddy?" And the tile guy kind of looks up. Mother says, "No, that's where I shot at Larry. Over there is where I shot at your daddy." So that's the way my mother was.
So looking back, why do you think you drank so much?
Because I'm an alcoholic. I mean, I don't think you choose to be an alcoholic. You know, the last thing I wanted to be was an alcoholic. You know, but I think there's in certain people, I think someday they'll identify it genetically. They're getting closer to it.
When you say you're an alcoholic, you mean you were drawn to drink or you couldn't control it? What do you mean you're an alcoholic?
Well, my definition of alcoholism is different than a doctor's or something. I always say if you have consequences directly stemming from your drinking, things that happen to you that are unacceptable to you, and you continue to drink, you're an alcoholic.
Did you always realize that there were negative consequences to your drinking? I mean, that you were going to pay for this in one way or another?
The thing is, alcohol works, especially for an alcoholic. When you first start drinking, you have more pleasure, I think, than non-alcoholics. My ex-husband, for instance, whom I call Warren in this book, I mean, he would have a couple of beers and he'd get sleepy and go to sleep. He didn't associate it with this, you know, great liberating, exciting event. So I think somehow we metabolize the alcohol. So initially, alcohol really works. But again, I think thinking of it as a disease is helpful because it actually progresses. If you think of it like cancer grows and there's more cancer and it grows and grows, if you think of your drinking progressing, it stops being that much fun, but you're still really compelled to drink. So that's the weird thing. You keep trying to get back to those early days when alcohol really worked. Meanwhile, you have told yourself or you've convinced yourself that this is a solution. This is a solution to your problems, is drinking. It blows off steam. It lets you relax. You know, nobody really understands what you're going through. You're convivial with your friends when you drink. You know, and you overlook that you hork your guts out outside your kid's daycare, say, you know, in the family station wagon. You know, I couldn't take my kid to daycare because I was too nauseous in the morning.
Did your husband realize how much you were drinking?
Oh, no, absolutely not. That's how I figured out to throw out the cans. I remember him saying, "Where's that case of beer I bought? We got some case of beer like at a Sam's Club or something, or I don't know, some cheap liquor store." And he would have literally one beer a night, you know, half a beer. You know, he just wasn't a big drinker. And he said, "Did you drink all this beer?" And I'm like, "Of course not. You probably drink more than you think." But yeah, I just want to point out that if you had looked at me, you would have seen a thin, well-dressed, slightly agitated or irritated person, you know, who drove a station wagon and lived in a nice suburb of Cambridge and taught it, you know, in the academic ghetto. I didn't look like a drooling, puking, listing, lunging alcoholic. I tried to keep that, although it was leaking out. So, you know, for me, the consequence for me of that drinking was wanting to blow my brains out, was having a black hole inside me that I poured liquor into and day by day undermining every dream I ever had. I mean, I remember thinking, I would sit on the back porch and drink whiskey and I would think, I would actually tell myself, I'm going to get up in the morning and run 5 miles. You know, I hadn't run a step since my baby had been born for like 3 or 4 years, and I'd be completely in the bag, just my head lolling around like one of those bobblehead dolls. And I would tell myself, I'm going to get up and I'm going to run 5 miles and then I'm going to write, you know, all morning until I go teach my class. It's crazy. It's crazy. So I wasn't pursuing my dream. I also wasn't pursuing my dream of being a mother. I wasn't emotionally present, I think, probably for my kid or my husband or anybody. I think I was just in this bleak mind state. It was just awful.
So when did the drinking start to get worse?
Doesn't that sound bad enough? I mean, isn't that bad enough?
Well, you said there was sort of you
I wanted to suck off the family muffler. You know, I mean, isn't that bad enough? God, I wound up in the mental Marriott. It was pretty bad.
The mental Marriott?
Yeah, I mean, when I stopped drinking, I was sick. I had to check into Harvard Infirmary. I was sick like I had the flu. I went through withdrawal. And that's the other thing. You stop drinking and you think, oh, you're going to feel better. The first 2 days you might, but by day three or four, you're going to start detoxing. And, you know, days 3 to 10, you're going to feel like you've been run over by a truck.
So what did it take for you to actually check in there? I mean, what got you to that point?
In some ways, I got healthy enough once I was sober to realize how really deeply clinically depressed I was. And I started to ask for help. I realized I couldn't stay sober by myself. I met a group of women who were also trying to stay sober. And I had a friend who was a Harvard social theorist. I call her Joan the Bone in the book, who was my spiritual advisor. I was complete atheist, you know. But she encouraged me to pray. And, you know, I don't even know how to tell you how ridiculous that was to me. I'd been an atheist my whole life. I'd never been baptized. I had no concept of a God, bad or good. It was just, it seemed like the Easter Bunny to me. So when did it get worse? Well, I almost drove into something that had more molecular density. I'd stayed sober for 90 days, and I was better. But I did notice that the people who stayed sober did talk about some spiritual thing. Even the ones who'd say, you know, the group is my higher power, or I have a sober self that I pray to. They had some practice, some spiritual practice of some kind. You know, maybe it was just counting breaths in the morning, 1 to 10, to quiet, you know, the mind, the ego. They had some, you know, south of your neck place that they could go into that was sustaining for them. I just had a big black hole in there I wanted to pour Jack Daniels in. So in some ways, I had gotten sober. I'd been sober for 90 days, and I had no intention of drinking, and I gave a poetry reading at Harvard, and it was a very, you know, by those standards, a very good success, and went out with some of my students, and just drank everything in sight, and the next thing I knew, I was hurtling towards a big piece of concrete on Storrow Drive. And I didn't hit it somehow. It didn't hit me, and that was the last drink I had.
Now, I know a lot of people talk about the being spiritual but not religious, but you're religious, right? I mean, you became a Catholic.
Yeah.
It wasn't just that you realized that you had this great gaping pit in your life, and so therefore you needed something spiritual to sort of pull you out of the drinking. I mean, you found God in whatever way that meant to you. And
baby Jesus. And the Blessed Mother and all the angels and saints. Oh, yeah. I drank the Kool-Aid. But that had nothing to do with anybody else. In fact, my son, we were praying, and I was maybe 4 or 5 years sober when he came to me one Sunday morning and said, I want to go to church. And I said, why? It never occurred to me to go to church. I'd never been in church. He said, I want to see if God's there. And so I did this thing we called God-a-rama, where we went to various churches and mosques and zendos and Southern Baptist and Episcopal and Unitarian and Jewish, and we went to a Jewish midrash. And I brought a paperback. I just brought my son the way I took him to soccer. I brought a mug of coffee and a paperback every Sunday. Anybody who would take us, I'd go along, but it was all for my son. If you had told me I was going to be a Catholic, I would have laughed myself cockeyed, you know, more likely to be a pole dancer at, you know, 40-something, whatever I was. So, yeah, and I have found a comfort in the church. A lot of things I'm sure I'm not the Pope's favorite Catholic. A lot of things with the church I'm not crazy about. But, you know, it's sort of like when you have a president you don't like or there's a war you don't like, you don't stop calling yourself an American. You know, you still vote. So even though there are things about the church hierarchy and doctrine that I don't like, I love the simple faith of the people. And I love the tradition of Catholics working with the poor, which is, of course, you know, every spiritual tradition has that. You know, the Muslims and the Buddhists, and they all have a thing about being nice to each other.
You've described this book as really a journey into awe, and you've just been talking about that. Has that affected your writing too? I mean, other than, you know, actually writing about your spiritual life, but has it changed the way you write?
Yeah, I actually pray about what to write. I ask the Holy Spirit to guide me every day to write kind of the next true thing. It's something Hemingway said, not Jesus. You know, he said, just write the next true sentence. And I sort of ask before I write to be of service and to write, you know, the next true thing, whatever is the true thing that I have to write.
Mary Carr is a prize-winning memoirist and author of The Liars Club. Steve Paulson spoke to her about her latest book, called Lit. Like Mary Carr, the late David Foster Wallace struggled with substance abuse. He wrote about Alcoholics Anonymous from a fictional point of view.
I'm Marshall Boswell. I teach American literature at Rhodes College in Memphis, and I'm also the author of Understanding David Foster Wallace. I'm going to read a passage from Infinite Jest that is set in Boston Alcoholics Anonymous community and concerns a character named Don Gately, who is one of the heroes of the novel, a former football star, heroin addict, and recovering substance abuser. And then the palsied newcomers who totter in desperate and miserable enough to hang in and keep coming and start feebly to scratch beneath the unlikely insipid surface of the thing Don Gately's found get united by a second common experience, the shocking discovery that the thing, AA, actually does seem to work, does keep you substance-free. It's improbable and shocking. When Gately finally snapped to the fact, one day about 4 months into his in-house residency, that quite a few days seemed to have gone by without his playing with the usual idea of slipping over to unit number 7 and getting loaded in some non-uremic way the courts couldn't prove, that several days had gone by without his even thinking of oral narcotics or a tightly rolled Dubois or a cold foamer on a hot day, when he realized that the various substances he didn't used to be able to go a day without absorbing hadn't even, like, occurred to him in almost a week, Gately hadn't so much felt grateful or joyful as just plain shocked. The idea that AA might actually somehow work unnerved him. He suspected some sort of trap, some new sort of trap. At this stage, he and the other Ennett residents, who were still there and starting to snap to the fact that AA might work, began to sit around together late at night, going back crazy together, because it seemed impossible to figure out just how AA worked. It did, yes, tentatively seem maybe actually to be working, but Gately couldn't for the life of him figure out how just sitting on hemorrhoid-hostile folding chairs every night looking at nose pores and listening to cliches could work. Nobody's ever been able to figure AA out, is another binding commonality. And the folks with serious time in AA are infuriating about questions starting with how. You ask the scary old guys how AA works, and they smile their chilly smiles and say, just fine. It just works is all. End of story. The newcomers who abandoned common sense and resolved to hang in and keep coming and then find their cages all of a sudden open mysteriously after a while share this sense of deep shock and possible trap. About newer Boston AAs with like 6 months clean, you can see this look of glazed suspicion instead of beatific glee. An expression like that of bug-eyed natives confronted suddenly with a Zippo lighter.
Marshall Boswell is the author of Understanding David Foster Wallace. Olivier Amessin had it all. A brilliant career as a cardiologist, a glittering social life. But what began as a few drinks to loosen him up at parties spiraled into an addiction that nearly claimed his life. As a doctor, he tried everything, from rehab to AA, to find a cure. In the end, what he found surprised him. Amessin writes about his quest in the book The End of My Addiction. He told Anne Strainchamps about his urge to drink.
The problem with alcoholism, and I was already addicted to it, is that I was overwhelmed by craving. So I went to a Chinese restaurant, but instead of eating, I ordered double vodka tonics, and actually 1, 2, 3, probably 4, 5, and I took a cab and ended up bleeding in that cab. And from that cab, I ended up going to the ER of the hospital I've been associated to for 21 years of my life. It's New York Presbyterian Hospital, Cornell University, where I was an attending physician and an associate professor of medicine.
When did you begin to realize that alcohol wasn't just a pleasure in your life, but was a real problem?
Alcohol, like you say, well, it was normal to have alcohol. It wasn't normal, actually, and I didn't like alcohol. I never, in fact, I disliked alcohol. And when I arrived in the States from France, I was a non-drinker. I started drinking the American way with scotch, hard liquor, and not at all wine. In fact, I drank only when I was invited to parties, and just because I felt shy. It's a social shyness, and with a glass of scotch, which I hated to drink, I just felt comfortable and well, and that's why I drank. But sooner or later, I needed no longer one glass to get that effect, but two, and then three, and without noticing, because it's an insidious disease, I became addicted and needed much more, up to almost a bottle.
What did you do about it?
The first symptom of that is denial. But when I found out that I was an alcoholic, the first thing I did was, as a physician, I thought, well, I'm told it's a disease. It's recognized as a disease since the 1950s by the AMA, the World Health Organization. So I'm going to seek medical advice, which I did. I went to see a psychiatrist. I went to see a neurologist. I got the best medical care. I asked what to do. Some told me to go to AA. Some told me they wouldn't go to AA. I ended up going to AA very faithfully. I took medications called anti-craving medication, but they didn't work. In the end, since my alcoholism was getting worse and worse, I ended up being hospitalized. I ended up going to detox and to rehabs for month and month. I got out, but each time I got out of rehab, the craving came back and I relapsed. And I thought that that was my story, and I was wondering why I was relapsing. But in fact, 90% of patients who become abstinent do relapse. 90% of them. People do relapse because of craving, and there is no medication that works, and that's admitted by the addiction community. So unlike high blood pressure, which you treat, and therefore people do not die, with alcoholism, 100 people die a year.
You must have been at the end of your rope when you finally stumbled on this new drug, baclofen.
I read a New York Times article in which a patient who was a paraplegic was prescribed a muscle relaxant for his spasms. He noticed he was a coke addict, that his cocaine craving and also his alcohol craving were reduced by that medication. So I thought, if that reduces craving, maybe I could take that and it would reduce my craving too. I in fact did, after checking with neurologists who are the experts of the drug. They told me it's a very safe drug. We've been using it for 40 years. We use it in a harmless condition for comfort care, so don't worry, just use it. And I used it and it reduced my craving and made me feel good. My anxiety went away. I felt much better, but the overwhelming craving came, and then the relapse came again. And that's when I came across, I started looking at the internet frantically. I mean, I knew I had to save my life, I mean, at that point. And I realized, I saw one study done in 1997 in animals, in rats, that had been addicted to cocaine. And in those rats, when you prescribe baclofen at low dose, those rats were seeking cocaine as they normally did, and I mean just normally, while when you reach a certain threshold, they just were not interested in cocaine at all and went for food or water. And the same happened with rats addicted to alcohol. They had lost their motivation at a given dose, but it was dose-dependent. And actually, researchers were looking at that and used baclofen, but they used too low doses. I mean, they didn't realize that what happens in animals can be transposed to humans. And that's what I did. I thought, if you reach the threshold at which they become indifferent to alcohol, maybe I'll be indifferent and the craving will go away. And that happened in February 14 when I did a protocol and increased progressively my dose. I reached a dose at which my craving completely went away, and I later published it a few months later, a complete indifference. It wasn't abstinence to alcohol. I could see alcohol and look at it as if it were an ashtray or a vase or a flower. I mean, it gave me no desire to drink. I could enter a bar, see people drink, and that had never been described. It was world premiere. Now we have approximately 100 patients worldwide who, and some of them were almost homeless, and within a few days of treatment, they just say, I'm not interested in alcohol, I feel good. The first thing is they start feeling good. They have a feeling of well-being, and they detach themselves from alcohol, and they say, I'm not interested at all. Some of them have a drink here and there. Or some of them, like me, are abstinent because I don't like alcohol, and I think I've had enough alcohol.
So what do you think is going on? How does baclofen work?
I don't want to be too technical, but it works on the dopamine release in the brain, in the amygdala. I mean, that's very technical. In the part of the brain which releases dopamine in excess in people who have addictions. So it has a very specific mechanism of action, unlike Valium, alcohol, and all other medications which work on one receptor in the brain in the GABA system, which is the GABA-A. It works on a different receptor called GABA-B. It's the one and only medication that actually in animals completely stops craving and in humans also completely stops craving and make people feel good. Also, there's no dependence. I mean, it's been used for 40 years and that's not a drug. In other words, in 40 years, not one case of dependency to that drug, I mean, of addiction has been described. It's not a replacement like methadone for heroin or like Nicorette or nicotine for cigarettes. I mean, it's a medication and nobody gets dependent on that, of course.
You know, alcoholism is a very expensive disorder. Wouldn't it be in the government's best interest and society's best interest to fund research into such a promising potential treatment?
It's an excellent point. The cost of alcoholism alone, I'm not even mentioning other addiction, is $200 billion in this country. Huge. A study of baclofen randomized trial would be maybe $1 million or so. But the good news is several centers like University of Pennsylvania, I've spoke with Charles O'Brien and with Anna Rose Childress, who are the leading expert there and nationwide leading experts, are starting now to use high-dose baclofen for cocaine addiction. Others are using it for alcohol. So clinical trials will take place. The only thing is we need to make sure that funding happens. The problem is it's a generic drug, and so basically there's no drug company to fund it, and that's why actually nobody has funded it.
So most drug research is actually done by the drug companies. And since baclofen has been around so long, there's no financial incentive for the drug companies to do any research on it?
Unfortunately, yes. I mean, there was an article in the New York Times which showed that even the FDA and the NIH do not look at conflict of interest between doctors working for drug company, how much money they make. So, I mean, there is. I'm not talking about most doctors, but some doctors are doing research and, I mean, basically are making a business of doing research of medication on medication that they know are not very useful. But, I mean, that's a moneymaker and it's a business. Whereas this one is extraordinarily, I mean, the potential is huge. But there is no financial interest to do that, and I mean no funding, basically. So the reason why I wanted to write this book is basically for the patient to go to the doctor and say, doctor, I want this medication, I'm dying, can I have it? And I discuss it with the doctor, and if the doctor thinks it is appropriate, the doctor will just prescribe it. And in addition, what I've asked for 4 years now in my papers is clinical trials. But they didn't happen, and they have to happen. I mean, I find it totally ethically unacceptable that those trials aren't conducted.
Dr. Emerson, thank you so much for talking with us today.
Thank you so much for having me.
Olivier Emerson is a physician who devotes his time to the treatment of addiction. His book, The End of My Addiction, is now out in paperback under the title Heal Thyself. Anne Strangechamp spoke with him. Coming up, getting hooked on Second Life.
My memories of Stephen or time together with Stephen, the way I would characterize Stephen and the wonderful things he's done, they haven't all been real life. When I go over those in my mind, I realize that I'm pulling many real-life memories, but also several second-life memories of times that we've shared in Second Life.
I'm Jim Fleming. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from PRI, Public Radio International. Technology addiction seems to be a hazard of our times. Sometimes we chat on cell phones, text friends, and tweet so frequently it can become compulsive. And online, technology is opening virtual worlds that we can disappear inside, if we want to. Filmmaker Jason Spingarn Coff was intrigued by the virtual worlds in Second Life. Every day, hundreds of thousands of users log on to Second Life and assume a role in alternate reality by choosing an avatar, a digital alter ego. Spingarn Coff followed real-life people as they immersed themselves in Second Life and, in so doing, changed the shape of their real lives and struggled with Second Life addiction. His documentary about the experience is called Life 2.0. He says you can become anyone you want to in Second Life.
No one knows who you are in real life or what people say First Life. So there's often this very stark difference between the First Life and the Second Life. And you choose a name which is different than your real name. So as you see in the film, one of the avatars is an 11-year-old girl, and the person controlling the avatar is a man in his 30s.
I felt like she was very familiar and somebody that I'd always known. It was some sort of exploration of something in my subconscious.
We were at Barnes & Noble, and he was looking at the psychologist Carl Jung, and he said something about, you know, how there's a male in every female and a female in every male concept that Jung has, and that he has created a girl avatar. And I said, well, why? What do you do with the girl avatar? And then he revealed to me that she was a child and how that's hugely frowned upon. And I remember thinking, well, I can see why.
People might think that's very creepy, and initially it is somewhat creepy, but over time you understand why he's doing this, and there's a whole community of adults whose avatars are children, because you have to be an adult, you have to be over 18 to join the main part of Second Life.
The story you start with is a woman who lives in New York and a man who lives in Calgary, is that right?
That's right.
Tell us about them.
Well, they're pretty normal-looking people. They seem like really anyone. Amy, who lives in Westchester, New York, has a child. She's married. She lives in a nice suburban home. And she's unfulfilled in real life. Something's missing. And she goes on to Second Life and falls in love with an avatar, this guy, who turns out to be living in Canada. And their avatars explore the kind of fantasy world of Second Life, going on dates and exploring beautiful sunsets and beaches. And they have this romance that blossoms, and then they decide they want to get together in real life.
I use the term emotional adultery because real world's hung up about physical sex, but what's really more important is the emotional attachment you have with someone.
Of course, up to this point, it has been this idealized world in Second Life where nothing can go wrong and they can be who they want to be, where they want to be, how they want to be for as long as they want to be. It must have been exciting to think about trying to pull that into real life for them.
Well, it's very common. There are a huge number of people who I've encountered in making the film who fall in love. You can even have a marriage, a wedding in Second Life. There are wedding planners in Second Life who do virtual ceremonies for avatars. This is a very popular feature of Second Life. And Amy and Steven, who I follow in the film, allow me to film them in real life. Remarkably, they let me in on what was an affair. They were cheating on their spouses. And they really wanted to build a new life together. And I follow that. You see how it unfolds.
It's interesting, isn't it? I mean, you must have thought of this at the time, that they must have already begun to blur the line between the two lives to let you in to film them having an affair in real life.
In their minds, the real and the virtual get completely mixed up. and their sense of themselves becomes a hybrid of the avatar and the real-life person. I think that's really fascinating.
It's not like I don't have a grasp on reality. I very much do. But my memories of Stephen, or time together with Stephen, the way I would characterize Stephen and the wonderful things he's done, they haven't all been real life. When I go over those in my mind, I realize that I'm pulling many real life memories, but also several second life memories of times that we've shared in second life.
The other story that we haven't talked about very much so far is this man who is in his 20s or 30s, who is engaged in first life and tells his fiancée that he has created an 11-year-old female avatar in second life, but she just doesn't want to know about it.
Well, it's kind of weird, you know, if your partner tells you, by the way, I'm an 11-year-old girl in second life and I'm up all night doing this. You wonder, and she wonders, I think quite reasonably, why.
Well, and you film him at one point online being the 11-year-old. Well, you do it at several points, but there is one, you use time-lapse photography, and it's clear he's there for, what is it, 12 hours on the computer?
I think in that instance, it's more than 14 hours straight. You see him up all night, and this is what he would do very frequently. He'd go on these binges, and he couldn't control it, and what was very fascinating is he talks about his avatar as another person, that she has a life of her own. He always talks about the avatar as she, not me. He felt like she had a life that she had to live out, and he was almost powerless. This happens to people. The experience in Second Life feels so real. It feels as real as anything they've ever felt in their lives. And if you have an imagination or certain friends that you start making in Second Life, it can really take over.
One of the things that I learned from her is that nothing is ever enough. And nothing was ever enough for her. Her family, her friends, the things she was doing. She always wanted more, and she always wanted new things, and she never stopped and finished anything. By watching her go through that over and over again, and never be happy with what she had, I was able to see that I am exactly the same way. And that's how I moved from having this great real life, which was amazing and I was very thankful for, to pursuing this second life for this other part of me that I really didn't have time for.
Well, it's such an odd thing. I think she says at one point that he would do this on his laptop, sitting in bed next to her while she was sleeping at night. And she would turn over and say, are you going to be on the computer? And he'd say, well, just a minute. And she'd wake up in the morning and he'd still be there, having been an 11-year-old girl all night long.
That's right. And I have to say, it was pretty difficult to film him because he was so immersed in this world, you could barely get his attention in real life. When we'd go to film him, he was often going without sleep. He was having a really hard time. And he'd speak very openly about this as an addiction, as this very dangerous addiction where he was putting everything at risk in order to pursue this second life.
Is he the one who has said that he will always be in virtual worlds, whether he's in second life or not, that there's just no stopping him?
That's right. He's committed, and he struggles with second life addiction. And what you see in the film can be very damaging, but it can also lead to things that he thinks are wonderful for him. At one point, he says, Second Life is the best thing and the worst thing that's ever happened to me, which I find really interesting, that this technology unleashes something which is so complicated. I don't want to pass judgment on it being necessarily a good thing or a bad thing. It's very much how people use it. But I felt I needed to make the film because the general public was getting this enormous amount of hype about Second Life. What they didn't know was what it was actually doing to people, and that you need to approach these worlds with some degree of caution.
It's 6:10 and I've been on it least 12 hours total. When the show was over, she went home to take apart her room, and she ended up being there ever since because some friends went with her. And a ton of other friends joined her at different points. Probably about 20 people have come through here, and these same three have been with her the whole time. Snoopy here is a girl who she met at Vortex. Snoopy right now is very much at a point that Aya was early on in Second Life, where she's just realizing how deep the addiction runs.
In terms of addiction, what makes Second Life different than a normal video game is there's a sense that this is real. There's no end to it. There are no points. There are no levels. It goes on forever. There's a sense that your friends who you meet in Second Life are your real friends, the real people. And if you forge very close relationships, you can go in there all the time and those friends can become the most important friends you have in your life. I don't think there's anything wrong with that necessarily. But if you have a partner or real life friends, at a certain point, you have to moderate it.
It's obviously a fascinating place. Then the fascination is not going to go away anytime soon, is it?
It's not. It's growing. Last year, there was about $500 million spent within Second Life. And I think this is the beginning. I think virtual worlds are a lot bigger than just Second Life. There are many more virtual worlds out there, and there'll be many more to come. So I think it's something we should watch and start thinking about the way we want them to be, the way we want to use them, and find a way to use them for good.
Jason Spingarn-Kolff is the director of the documentary Life 2.0. The film was screened at 2010 Sundance Film Festival. If you want to hear this program again, check an author's name, or find out about a piece of music we used, visit our website. It's ttbook.org. To buy a copy of the program, call the radio store at 1-800-747-7444. Ask for program number 37A, Telling Addiction. To the best of our knowledge, is produced at Wisconsin Public Radio. This hour was produced by Veronica Rickert, with help from Mary Lou Finnegan, Anne Strainchamps, Doug Gordon, and Charles Monroe Kane. Our executive producer is Steve Paulson. Our technical director is Kirill Owen. You can stream To the Best of Our Knowledge on our website at ttbook.org, where you will also find a link to the weekly podcast.
PRI, Public Radio International.